Good morning. Hawaii's needs for more affordable housing continues to accelerate. Today, Kauai County will consider a bill to add more small rentals by making zoning changes in Lihue. And with national politics far from your home, what may really matter to you is what happens at home. Contributing editor Neil Milner brings us some of the research about the effects of neighborhoods. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Hot weather climates love hot food, so the dog days of summer are a good time for a chili pepper festival. They also might be a good time to try your hand at sand sculpture. Don't expect it to last forever, though.
It's Wednesday, August 10th. That's The Conversation, starting right after this news. For everybody born under the sign of Leo and the fact that today is, I am told, World Lion Day. So there you are, thinking about eternity. Good morning.
I guess now I know.
I guess we were so stunned by all that.
Exactly.
We forgot to say good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, equally stunned as Chris Vandercook.
Still taking it all in, yeah.
Well, we're going to take in a lot more than that. Now, with all the emphasis on national politics right now, it could be really easy to feel a loss of control or importance over the big issues that shape the country. But for most people, it's the place where they live that shapes their lives, their neighborhoods. People in Hawaii often identify themselves by which neighborhood they call home. And while these identifiers might be used by other people to stereotype folks, recent research shows more substance to the effects of neighborhoods. Even in the age of globalization, with the ability to quickly keep outside the place or keep contact outside the place near you, neighborhoods matter. So says contributing editor Neil Milner, who's back with all the reasons why. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, you know, we've talked about this before in some ways that, you know, controlling the things that you can control. But in really looking at why our neighborhoods are important, intuitively may think, well, you know, it's close to home. This is where you live. This is probably what you notice as you're coming up. But maybe that's not exactly right, or maybe that's more of a romantic notion. So why are neighborhoods really important?
Well, the notion you gave isn't so much romantic. It's just kind of empty. It doesn't have much substance in it. And what's interesting about the three pieces of material that I'm going to talk about, actually three different books, is that they put some substance to it. And one of them is a book that's a couple years old now by Robert Sampson called Great American Cities. And what Sampson shows in very nitty-gritty sense is that, first of all, neighborhoods vary within a city. He uses Chicago. He does this enormous study. Neighborhoods vary. No big surprise there. But the most interesting thing is that the effects of a neighborhood linger. Even as new people move in and old people move out, the effects linger. And so what he's showing is that it's not so much just how an individual behaves. It's the space that the individual lives in.
So we're talking about the characteristics
of
characteristics,
the community that begins grassroots
to shape you as much as you are there trying to shape it?
That's right. Like a good example would be what's called collective efficacy. Some neighborhoods have grassroots stuff that really seems to work. We're not talking about very well-publicized stuff. They might have church networks, other kinds of social networks. People who live in these communities are more likely to be altruistic. There's less likely to be crime. And what Sampson has done is really to refocus the orientation so that some of the reforms now is how do you strengthen neighborhoods that way. And then two other books in very different perspectives, Matthew Desmond's book called Evicted.
And we've talked about him
before. We've talked about that before, and we'll come back to that in this context. And Yuval Levin, who's actually a conservative social critic, what he says about how you can model virtue by doing neighborhood work.
Okay, but staying with this issue of collective efficacy,
yeah.
I mean, that's one that maybe is a little difficult to get your head around in some ways to understand, because people always think that, you know, they make the difference, that if you move into a neighborhood and you do certain things or have certain, you know, values or what have you, that you begin to shape it. But what I hear you saying is that really, truly, there's an effect that a neighborhood has on you, and that that lingers even if you move out.
Well, the neighborhood thing lingers. Yeah, I don't want to deny, and he doesn't deny the importance. An individual can certainly make changes. But what he's saying is that when an individual is in a neighborhood, that individual is product of a lot of little kinds of social networks, the way people react to each other, are their grassroots organizations, and that very much, in ways that are not even always clearly understood by individuals, that affects their kind of behavior. That is, it isn't just individual behavior, and it isn't just individuals linking outside the neighborhood. Where you live and how that gets manifested in the grassroots kinds of things that are in that community affect the way they are. It can be fragile. If people come in and start behaving in very different ways, for example, that's always possible. Then you can lose some of this collective efficacy.
Which is what we've seen when we've seen certain neighborhoods become incredibly run down, or very run down neighborhoods become gentrified all of a sudden.
That's right. Although, again, the gentrification is an interesting. He doesn't talk about that here, but some of that old neighborhood stuff continues to exist even as you begin to gentrify.
So what happens when people have a loss of neighborhood? Let's say they get evicted, or they are homeless and they are moving from place to place. Now here, the kids will stay in the same school in many places, but in other cities and other locations, you just literally have uprooting. What happens when there's
a loss of neighborhood? Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted, which we've talked about before, really comes in here. And it's a way to think about the effects of neighborhoods by looking at people who are totally bereft of neighborhoods, who essentially lose the kinds of linkages that you would have in a neighborhood. And that's people who are evicted and get evicted very often. And what happens to them is I call it, they lose their nuts and bolts citizenship. But what that really means in very concrete senses is that the neighbors that they used to have, who would help watch their kids and who would watch the streets, they don't have them anymore because they keep having to move from neighborhood to neighborhood. They keep moving because of money issues into places that are not collectively efficient. That is, they're not good neighbors. Their kids, as you say, have to keep changing schools. Here, that's not the case for homeless people. They can continue to go to the same schools, but even so, their after-school activities of their kids are limited because they can't stay as late because they have to get back somewhere. And so when you look at what it's like not having these kinds of linkages, you begin to understand more clearly things that you might take for granted by just living in a place over a longer period of time. That doesn't mean you're sharing barbecues with your neighbors or that you're making nice, but it means there's a kind of familiarity there.
And what you're really, I think, talking about are the loss of those constants in our lives that we don't really stop to think about until they're gone.
Yeah, because most of us, you and I, don't have to think about them very much because they're there. We're not getting run out of our, we have what's important, which is a home. And what comes with that, besides just shelter, is all these other things.
Okay, we only have a couple more minutes, but I want to ask you about what you alluded to a little earlier about, modeling behavior and sort of modeling your view of virtue in a neighborhood. And that's a very different situation than saying, all the people in this area do such and such.
Yuval Levin is a conservative social critic. And one of the most interesting things about Yuval Levin is that he says to social conservatives, the religious right, he says, you have to quit feeling martyred. You have to quit feeling beleaguered. You have to quit thinking that you can force your virtue on other people. There's not that kind of moral consensus anymore. What you can do best is to live your own notion of life, your own notion of virtuous life, kind of a traditional morality. And what you can do is to model that by working in your community. That is, that you become not so much a religious conservative, but a person who believes in those values, who's doing good community work with other people who may have other values, and get to see what you're doing and get to see you as a model citizen, perhaps, and maybe adopt your values and maybe not. But you see, it's a little less direct, but it's a sense of how you can, what neighborhoods can do. And it's very much consistent with conservatives' view that the local is very important.
So what I hear you saying is that, the idea of just acting as a human being and understanding that you don't necessarily have to have labels applied. That's difficult for a lot of us because, you know, we like to be able to sort people and put them into categories. But in this idea of just, you know, modeling your own personal virtue of having to be an individual and going out and doing something in that way and forging relationships based on who you are and what you do, but not what label has been affixed to you, perhaps by yourself or by other people.
Well, that's right. And that's a quick way to think about the difference between national politics as it exists right now during political campaigns and your other parts of life. National politics is very much about broad categories. How are the evangelicals voting? How are social conservatives voting? What are various kind of categories doing? What the neighborhood reminds you, at least what Yuval Levin reminds you, is that there are things that you can do that make you part of a community and where these kinds of identities merge so that it isn't about a single identity. So in very different perspectives, then, we see different ways that the neighborhood can be or is important in people's lives.
Let's talk a little bit about how this applies to Hawaii. I mean, because here we are very far from everybody else geographically, and you would think that we would understand, perhaps better than most, that our neighborhood interaction is really important. Do we behave in the same ways as you've seen evidenced in these studies?
You know, the best answer I can give is that we really don't know, because studies of Hawaii neighborhoods, that kind of sociological tradition, that kind of ways of finding out the nitty-gritties of neighborhood, simply has never been applied here. What we probably can say is that compared to some other cities, this is places less segregated by race and ethnicity, but that doesn't tell us very much. I think there's reasons. There are two things you can say about Hawaii, one of which is that these findings are plausible. That is, they're worth looking at. It's worth thinking about cities, neighborhoods here. It's worth thinking as you do transit-oriented development to think about what that would mean for a good neighborhood. But at the same time, we don't know very much about it. The other thing is to keep in mind how often all we do with neighborhoods when we talk about them is sort of stereotype them. You're from Hawaii Kai, well, that means such and such. You're from Kalihi, that means such and such. We really don't. There's a lot more we should know about these kind of grassroots effective and ineffective neighborhoods that we really don't know right now. But I think there's every reason to believe that space, that where you live is important in Hawaii in this day and age, even though you now have Facebook, you now have social media, where your community in some ways expands, still the idea of where you live and what that does to you and your community and your neighbors is important in Hawaii also.
And the same thing in terms of bringing effective change just in the community situation?
Well, yeah. I think that, well, you've heard me talk about this before. One of the ways to get around political gridlock is to pay attention to the things in your own community that you can do, where you can cut through some of these ideological blinders and work together. That's what James Fallows found when he did this stuff, and we talked about that before. He looked at communities where people with very different political notions just got aggravated or impressed or whatever and began to work together on some very concrete kinds of things. Not explicitly to avoid political differences, but they just didn't become as important. They had kind of shared work where those weren't issues.
And one final thought, because we talk a lot about neighborhoods. Well, a lot of neighborhoods have neighborhood boards. Is there a disconnect between the neighborhood and what you do in your neighborhood and the neighborhood board?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if we, again, I don't think there's good research on neighborhood boards. I don't think there's any reason to assume. In fact, I'll go beyond that. There's no reason to assume that neighborhood boards alone create this kind of neighborhood efficacy that Sampson finds in some places or the lack of such efficacy. There's much more to it than that if you look at the kinds of things that he was looking at, the social networks.
Okay, so bottom line, before we say goodbye, this really comes down to an individual being willing to do something based on his or her own values and creating the relationships within communities and within a neighborhood to be able to bring substantive change.
Right, but on the other hand, to remember how much the lingering effects of neighborhood, the historical neighborhood, is affecting the way that individual is going to act and the way that individual is going to have to act if he or she is trying to change things.
Much more about neighborhoods than we thought we knew. Thanks, Neil.
Really? Thank you.
Political scientist Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Longview. He'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Are elections free and fair? Until he was winning the nomination, one grumpy candidate said elections were rigged.
I'm telling you, November 8th, we better be careful because that election's going to be rigged.
The broader question of how the system can be gamed for any candidate. Is the Electoral College the ultimate rig in the presidential sweepstakes? That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:19 and coming up, the many, many uses of the chili pepper. But first, your quiz.
We're going to talk about a very hot edible in just a moment, but in today's backyard quiz, we're remembering an early European visitor to the Hawaiian Kingdom who's credited with importing dozens of edible plants. He was a Spaniard who arrived in the islands in either 1793 or 94 and soon became a favorite of Kamehameha I. He served the king in several capacities, but earned much of his early fame in Hawaii for his ability to import and cultivate fruit and vegetables. As Kenneth Nagata wrote in the Hawaiian Journal of History, quote, his gardens attracted the attention of tourists and botanists alike. He grew onion, pineapple, horseradish, cabbage, asparagus, corn, tea, cotton, cocoa, and lots of other crops. He's believed to have produced the first wine in Hawaii, and Honolulu's Vineyard Boulevard is named for his orchard. This morning, we're looking for the name of this European adventurer and horticultural pioneer, and we'll be back with it in half an hour. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you get the T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, working to protect and manage Oahu's drinking water resources for life. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
There are as many varieties of chili peppers as there are ways to prepare them, and Hawaii's ideal growing climate has spawned a number of intrepid growers and chefs who love what chilies can do to spice up a dish. This Saturday offers an opportunity to learn just how detailed a study of the humble chili pepper can get. There's a chili pepper festival at Pearl Ridge, and its organizer, Pam Boyer, is with us in our studio. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
We bite into a dish with lots of peppers in it, lots of chilies in it, knowing that it's going to kind of sting, right?
Yes.
So why do it?
Well, something chemically happens in our bodies when we do bite into a chili pepper. The pain is so intense that it sends these chemicals to the brain, and it sets off endorphins because the endorphins minimize the pain. And so we actually start feeling euphoric from eating chili peppers.
Well, so we sort of get a protective reaction, if you will, from the brain.
Yes.
We protect ourselves against the chilies and somehow enjoy that,
right?
Yes. But there are also a lot of other benefits. They're very high in vitamin C.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you heard, but Hillary Clinton said she eats a jalapeno a day just to keep her well in her campaign and so she doesn't get sick. So
really?
I think they have a lot of benefits.
So it can actually sort of ward off?
I feel they're like an antiseptic if you eat it every day.
Really? What other benefits are touted for chilies?
I'd like to talk about how they actually measure the units of heat.
Yeah.
I found that really interesting. There was a man in 1912 named Wilbur Scoville, and he actually tried to figure out how to measure how hot chili peppers were. And the way they do it, when we hear like 100,000 units or 500,000 units, as far as the Scoville units, it's how much water it takes to dilute the chili pepper so that it's not hot anymore.
Uh-huh.
So the bigger the number, the hotter the chili pepper is.
So you can actually, you would think that would be an entirely subjective thing, right? How hot is a pepper? But if you look at it that way, you can actually give it a numerical value.
Yes, absolutely. And I think also, besides the heat of peppers, each pepper has its own flavor.
Yeah.
And we were talking a little earlier, what's happening now in the chili industry is it's so popular, but people don't necessarily want the heat, but they want the flavor of the chili. So they're hybriding them to be less hot, but still have the full flavor of the chili.
Hybriding being just a matter of picking seeds that are less intense.
Spicy. Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and sort of commingling them.
Yes, absolutely. Not genetically modifying it. So
yeah.
It's just within the chili peppers themselves.
The same kind of modification has been going on with edible plants since
absolutely.
The dawn of time.
Yeah,
right?
That's how we make produce better and better.
Yeah.
If we can keep just taking the best of each species. You know, in Hawaii, CTAR has been working for years now on growing the chili peppers to see, you know, if it's a viable product here. So they've concentrated most on jalapeno, habanero, Hawaiian chili pepper, and the Thai chili pepper.
CTAR being the College of Tropical Agriculture at UH.
Yeah, so Ted Radovich has been doing a program with that, and CTAR will be out at our chili pepper festival talking to people about the different kind of chilies that they have and sampling little tastes of it. And also Master Gardeners will be. Last year, Master Gardeners was out there, and they let you pick seeds of a certain chili pepper, whichever, if you want spicy or mild, and you get to plant it and take it home so you can actually plant in your garden so you can come out and growing more food from our festival.
You referred to a kind of chili industry. Are there people in Hawaii seriously growing chilies in different varieties here?
I think it's just beginning.
Yeah.
I would say, like I was talking earlier to you about the cacao festival we had years ago, and there was hardly any cacao trees planted. And now everybody is planting cacao trees. And so I'm hoping within the years that this Chili Pepper Fest helps make more awareness for Hawaii, because it's a no-brainer. Hawaii hot sauce, Hawaii salsa. I mean, we can use this as a value added, which will bring
sure.
more recognition in the global view for Hawaii in our foods. Like, we're getting so well-known for our cacao. We're already known for our coffee. So this could be one more thing that we could be known for.
And both being examples of sort of small boutique agriculture
yes.
Ventures, because you don't necessarily need a lot of acreage for chilies, for example, do you?
I don't think so. No, not at all. And they grow so quickly. Like
they do.
If you look at the Hawaiian chili pepper, those bushes, if you've ever seen them, the bushes are huge and there's so many peppers on them. And, you know, for me, I truly feel boutique agriculture in Hawaii is so important because our farmers get high dollar
mm-hmm.
for what they're planting. And then we also get well known in the world for
sure.
some of the good things that we can grow here.
Well, since you run a couple farmers markets, you get to deal with a lot of small farmers in Hawaii. Are they glad they chose that as a vocation? Is it working out for them?
You have to have passion for farming if you're going to farm. You have to love what you do every day, being connected to the land. We small farmers are just growing more and more day by day here. The Farmers Union, Hawaii Farmers Union United, is really supporting a lot of the family farmers. We have about 800 members, and we are really working on getting these farmers to grow regeneratively with Korean natural farming, Jadam, all different ways to help put microbes back in the soil so we can grow healthier food here. And we truly believe that biodiversity in agriculture is the key for us, not monocropping.
When you say microbes back in the soil, has a lot of soil been depleted by industrial ag over the
years? It really has. It really has. So but it doesn't take very much to get those microbes back in the soil. So it's such an easy thing to do.
It's a really good direction for things to be taking, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Actually, I've been in agriculture for 40 years, and I'm so excited about the Korean natural farming that I'm actually taking a class on it. And this is like a milestone for me.
Still,
maybe one day I'll farm.
Still new things to learn, huh, Pam?
Yeah, I wanted to tell you a couple of things that we're going to have out at the festival. You know, we love for people to learn about agriculture, but we like to do it in a fun way. So since it's hot sauce and hot peppers, we're going to have a Latin DJ, DJ Ever, out there. And for 4 hours, he is going to be playing Latin music. We got a dance floor out there. And so you can come out and dance. We have Hawaii Salsa 101. They're going to come out. And if you want to learn how to dance, they can teach you how to dance. Or if you just want to come out with your dancing shoes.
If you eat the right peppers, you'll be dancing involuntarily. Right?
We're going to have a chili roaster that we brought from Hatch, New Mexico. And I don't know if any of the audience knows about Hatch chili peppers, but they're very famous around the world, and they have huge festivals. And so we'll have a chili roaster out there, and we'll be roasting chilies that people can taste. And it's our third anniversary out of Pearl Ridge, so we'll be giving out ancho chili chocolate cake for all our customers that come while it lasts. And Sears is giving out a grill. There's just so much stuff that's going to be happening, things for the kids. And
what's not to like, Pam?
Yeah, it's really going to be fun. Thank you.
Pam Boyer is the co-owner of the Pearl Ridge Farmers Market, which is sponsoring a chili pepper festival this Saturday from 8 a.m. to noon. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
There's a radio station that tells important stories, and you probably know which one we're talking about. Thank you to these station members who believe in Hawaii Public Radio and the stories we tell. Stephen Dubay of Kapa'a, David and Junko Davis of Honolulu, and Joanna Dokolo of Kailua Kona. You can join them with your membership dollars. You can call us at 955-8821 during business hours to find out more, or go online at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for today's programming comes from the BIA Remodel It Right Expo, featuring 3 days of seminars designed to help with home remodeling projects, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Blaisdell, biahawaii.org.
Polls say Oahu wants the rail to run all the way to Ala Moana. How to pay for it? Well, that's another matter, and one that's the focus of all three candidates for Honolulu mayor. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We've watched all three candidates talk about rail a lot. Certainly it's being touted as the issue that's driving the primary. As you look at how they line up with Kirk Caldwell and Peter Carlisle kind of on one side of it and Charles Dejoux on the other, what are the defining lines and shades of meaning that you're hearing for the ways in which they think that they're going to be able to pay for rail.
Well, it's interesting. And by the way, there are actually 8 other candidates running for mayor. I just have to remind people, but we're focused on the top 3, which I think makes sense. But it's interesting. All 3 of these candidates actually support going to Alamoana. Even Charles DeJoux says, look, if there's funding available, let's go to Manoa. They even agree that they're not going to raise property taxes to take care of this. That's something that all 3 share as well. The big difference is that Caldwell and Carlisle believe that it's going to take $1.5 billion to get to Alamoana. And Charles DeJoux simply says, nope, we're not going to use any more money other than what has already been allocated. He says that a $5 million rail line should be fine for $7 billion. We shouldn't spend any more money. So that's one very, very big difference. But the reality check here is none of them know exactly where extra money might come from. They are open to some ideas. They have laid out various positions, but nobody knows for sure where to get that deficit money, which would be needed to get to Alamoana.
The idea that, you know, going back to the federal government to say, look, it's costing more, it needs more money, but you're in effect asking for the same amount of money that they originally gave.
And it's probably going to be a tough sell, even though the FTA, Mayor Caldwell believes, wants to help Honolulu with rail. That's what it does. It helps people, helps governments, helps cities and states with transportation projects. It might be tough to tap them for more funding. There is another option that's been raised, what's known as the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, TIFIA they call it. And that's loans, loan guarantees, lines of credit from the federal government. But that hasn't been fully explored yet. That is one possibility, though.
And what about this idea that, well, maybe we can get some private folks to chip in for this, you know, for big money, $40 million. That's, you know, not necessarily chump change, but if you're talking about being able to develop around a rail station, maybe it could be worthwhile.
Right. The mayor says, you know, the typical station is around $40 million, probably more like $50 million at Alamoana because it'll be larger. But he's had conversations with Howard Hughes Corporation, General Growth Properties, Kamehameha Schools, basically big landowners and developers in the area that might be willing to chip in to help pay for that. But they want something in exchange, help with sewer infrastructure. They want to build more affordable housing. No major landowner or developer has yet committed publicly to this, but that is something that the mayor would like to explore. Even Carlisle has been open to that idea, or a similar private interest.
And what about this skim, that 10% skim?
Right, that's the GET surcharge that's levied only on Oahu folks. That money goes to the state legislature for its own purposes. The mayor has estimated it could be as much as $440 million over the life of the extension, right? The surcharge goes to 2027. Of course, he wanted it to go more. But that's something the legislature has not been willing to give up. But the argument is, gee, Oahu's paying for that, giving that money to the state. Why not use that for the rail line? But right now, that's off the table. And given the legislature's reluctance to fund this thing further, I don't see them coming forward unless they have what the mayor says, skin in the game. The city is showing that it's able to get money from other resources.
Which brings us back to sort of the beginning of this conversation, which is that everybody wants rail to go to Alamoana and still no real idea about how we're going to pay for it, the rest of it. Talk to you in the morning, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, you're going into deep space.
Yeah, you know, last week we went into not out of the Earth's orbit, but this time we're going to go way beyond the Earth's orbit and look at the exoplanets, one of our favorite topics. And there are just a slew of announcements coming out nowadays about new discovery of these planets that are outside of our solar system, revolving around stars, you know, in our galaxy. And so we'll talk to a couple of astronomers from the Institute for Astronomy and find out, you know, what kinds of planets are they uncovering and what kinds of features do they have? Are they in the Goldilocks zone where we're finding potential planets that are much like Earth? And what's the kind of the indication of that actually existing? The other thing that we're kind of interested in, Chris, is that there's this, through some of the exploration that people are doing as a result of Kepler, they found this star called the Tabby Star, and it's sort of flickering in a way that is they just don't understand how it's being done, and uh-huh. they think there's a mega structure around the star. How do you like that?
Wow.
So we'll talk about that. See if our invited guests have any insight into what this mega structure around this Tabby star might be like.
Yeah, no kidding. Tell me real quick what the Goldilocks zone is.
The Goldilocks zone is in that area around a star that is similar to Earth's orbit. Oh. So if a planet is revolving around a star, which is somewhat similar to what our Earth is orbiting around our sun, that's the Goldilocks zone. And that's where you have, a predictable sort of day. You have a predictable temperature for that planet. So if it's too close, like say Mercury or Venus, it's too hot, right? If it's too far away, like Mars or Jupiter, it's too cold.
But it could sustain life.
That's right, possibly. So we're looking at the composition of atmospheres now.
They're out there, Merc.
Yep.
Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Hi, I'm Ron Ortiz II from Haleiwa. You're tuned to HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HIConversation.
You can't live in Hawaii without knowing that the state has an affordable housing shortage. Island to island, counties are trying different ways to narrow the gap, even a little. On Kauai Today, the Planning Committee of the County Council will take up a bill to change zoning requirements to add small units to the Lihue community. Bill 2627 is in its second draft and would allow an easing of restrictions to give support to the construction of additional rental units on properties that meet proposed requirements. Deborah DeLuis is the chair of the Kauai Community Alliance, a collaborative working together to end homelessness and create sustainable housing options on Kauai and the state of Hawaii. She's on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Good morning. Let's talk some numbers here. In the bill itself, it references the Lihue Community Plan approved last June 2015. And it says that it's anticipated that over the next 25 years, 10,000 additional new housing units are going to be necessary to accommodate the population growth, and that in the Lihue district alone, that about half of that would have to be absorbed. And that would mean adding about 4,600 units to the current housing stock. If you sort of, project that over that 25-year period, that would be about 184 units annually. Even in the last 6 years or last 5 years, has that amount actually been added, or if not, how many?
That's an excellent question. I don't have a complete exact answer, but I will tell you we have been adding housing slowly, not at the rate that we need to. Obviously, we understand that.
I'm sorry, you understand that what?
We understand that we need additional housing units. Another feature of this ordinance is to look at encouraging local individuals who have accessory dwelling units or ohana units to use those as rentals too, to get those into the market, as well as not relying completely on building new facilities. It's just not going to happen.
Well, again, going back to what it says in the bill and the numbers it's referencing, that if approximately 2,000 of the units could be accommodated as they put by planned developments, well, that still leaves that 2,600 that would have to be attached to something that's already there within the inventory, which goes back to the existing properties. When you look at the properties that are available, has there been an inventory of how many might actually be able to accommodate something like, you know, an additional rental unit?
We've looked at several different communities. We don't have a specific number. We hear numbers like that there are several thousand units right now that are being advertised online for vacation rentals that are most likely not registered legal vacation rentals. Those are the kinds of units we could use, though, for permanent housing for small families or individuals.
The lot size determines how big a unit you can build. So if you've got a lot that's roughly 5,000 to 7,499 square feet, not roughly, but exactly, you'd be able to have a 400 square foot unit. If you're 7,500 or above, then you get 800 square feet that you could build. These are not, you know, super, obviously, you know, they're tiny and they're meant to be small and very affordable rentals. But clearly the concern over whether those units would be used for family members to house, you know, kids, or whether these units, in fact, would, as you suggest, be other, you know, rentals, short-term rentals, even though in the bill that's clearly stipulated against. All this means that somebody's going to have to be doing a lot of checking. Is there enough to be able to make sure that this would happen in the appropriate ways prescribed?
That's another challenge for a community, and particularly a small rural community. The county is looking at that. I work for a private nonprofit, so we wouldn't be involved in that, but the county is addressing those issues.
But obviously, as you've been trying to work to get more of these units available to meet the purposes of your alliance, looking to be able to house people who need a home, who need some place to call home, that's got to be a big concern.
It is. It's a huge concern. And we're certainly looking to the community as well as the public agencies to help with that.
So how do you, you know, make the case for someone who says, well, look, you know, it's my house, and yes, I may be able to rent this out to somebody else, but I really need it for my kids, or I really need it for another family member? Is there any sort of, you know, view of that as being able to take, you know, one more person out of need, whether that person is family or not?
Yes, and one of the things that a lot of the agencies here, the nonprofit agencies, offer are to be that broker between the property owner and the client, so that if a property owner rents to someone who is a client of one of the agencies, they have someone who can advocate for both sides to make sure that the rental stays full, that the person who is living there is taking their responsibility seriously, and also that the landlord has someone so they don't feel they have to deal with that by themselves.
And that's also what's happening on Oahu, being able to have that person, whether it's for a veteran or for someone else who's trying to be housed, to make sure that, you know, payments will be made and that someone will be there to help advocate on behalf of not just the client, but, you know, the landlord too. Any sense of what landlords, you know, are telling you? I'm sure you've been talking to them and having, you know, mini landlord summits. Do they seem to be open to putting up more of these? Or is there a sense from the real estate community that there are people who would look at a piece of property and think maybe they would want to build something?
There seem to be people who are willing to consider that, particularly if the tax issues are resolved, mm-hmm. and they know that they can do it legally. So I think, yeah, I think it's a small community, and for Kauai, the small mom and pop rentals are the ones that are willing to compromise a little bit more and work with people.
Because, in fact, it's a small community and it's very visible. You see people and know people.
Yes.
So at this point, with the planning committee looking at this today, is there a sense that this is, that, you know, many of the concerns which had to do with who's going to get the rental, and is there a way of being able to make sure that it happens in the appropriate way? Do you think that those concerns have been met?
You know, most of the people that I'm around most of the time are either houseless individuals who are trying to get housing or my coworkers and people who are in this field. So naturally, the people that I hear from seem very supportive of that. The property owners, we have several property owners who are very optimistic and seem to be willing to get involved in something like this, too. In fact, on the committee, there are several developers who bring their expertise to this discussion, too.
And as developers, I mean, they would be able to engage in this in some way with the larger scale units. But when you're talking about building, you know, the onesie, the twosie that are attached to a single family home already built, is that something that these developers would also be involved with? Are they that, I mean, are they that big? Are you talking about smaller, more, smaller construction firms?
Probably it would be more on the smaller side. The individuals that we work with, most of the landlords we work with here for low-income affordable rentals are again, family-owned properties. They're small. They're not 200-unit complexes.
So there might be a little bit of business in there for a lot of people. We'll see what happens later on today. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Deborah DeLuise is the chair of the Kauai Community Alliance. It's a collaborative that works to end homelessness and create sustainable housing options on Kauai and also throughout the state. She sits on the board of Bridging the Gap, the continuum of care for homelessness for islands other than Oahu.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. King William Lunalilo had vast land holdings on each of the five major Hawaiian islands. He left instructions that after his death, his estate was to be converted into a trust fund for a home for destitute or ill people of Hawaiian ancestry. Kapuna were to be given preference over younger people. Lunalilo died in 1874, and to comply with his wishes, all of his lands were sold, and the proceeds were converted into a trust to finance the home's construction and maintenance. This was the first charitable trust created by a land-owning ali'i. The Lunalilo home is still in use today and offers Meals on Wheels, hospice care, residential care, and adult day care to the Hawaiian people and the general population as well. Over the years, many have given generously to Lunalilo's home. These are prime examples of people helping people, and it all started because a big-hearted Hawaiian monarch wanted to give back. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
In today's backyard quiz, we told you about a man who grew dozens of edible plants in his Oahu gardens in the early decades of the 19th century and is credited with bringing many of them to Hawaii for the first time. Honolulu's Vineyard Boulevard is named for his pioneering wine-growing efforts. He came to Hawaii aboard the Lady Washington in either 1793 or 1794 at the age of 20 after deserting from a Spanish naval vessel. It didn't take him long to start a family. He's credited with several children from at least three wives. He was a favorite of Kamehameha and Kaahumanu, who gave him the tracts of land he needed for his horticultural experiments. Historians disagree as to just how many edible plants he introduced to Hawaii, but it's likely we owe our enjoyment of pineapple, guava, coffee, papaya, mango, and avocado to Don Francisco de Paula Marin.
And Christian Yee called in from Liliha, just a few blocks away from Vineyard, knew the answer and will be receiving the T-shirt. Thanks very much. Glad you knew it and for playing the backyard quiz with us, talking about a lot of edibles in this backyard quiz. You were talking about the chili pepper, sort of the onslaught of the different types of chili peppers that we may be seeing, in the same way that we've been seeing lots of Hawaii chocolate and coffee and other boutique farming. And who knows what we may see yet with chili peppers.
Hawaii has so much potential for lots of small farms with a wide variety of things that they grow. So we'll see where that goes.
But well, we're often told that, you know, no farms, no food. And right. What kinds of farms are being developed and what that means for value-added product that can be marketed elsewhere as well as to all of us for our own uses. Yeah, chilies, good stuff.
It's going in the whole no farms, no food is going in a very good, that movement is going in some very good directions.
Well, we'll see, too, what happens with that chili chocolate cake. Actually, that's pretty good stuff. That's going to do it for us for this Wednesday. We'll be coming back with you tomorrow. Going to sit down with Sarah Park, the state epidemiologist, and get up to speed on Hep A and what's been happening since the CDC arrived last Sunday night. We'll also be talking with Big Island mayoral candidate Wally Lau.
And we'll look at a Maui Hula Festival that celebrates a family heritage. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
And as we always tell you, if you missed any part of the show or you just want to hear something else again, you can always find it on the Conversation page under Talk Shows. And we have that's in the archive on Hawaii Public Radio. publicradio.org. Just again, look under the Conversation and you'll find it.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of the Conversation.